are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to the show on Wednesdays, 5 o'clock after calendar, or again on Saturday at 12:30. Today, I'm really pleased to be interviewing a Puget Sound author. Her name is Kathleen Akala, and she's the author of short story collections, three novels, and most recently, a book, you might call it part memoir, partially a book about environmental sustainability. The title is The Deepest Roots, Finding Food and Community on a Pacific Northwest Island. Now, Kathleen is here with us today. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you, Chris.
I want you to start by reading something from your book. We'll talk about it later in the program, but I think it really captures your storytelling, your great writing ability, and will capture our audience if you read that for us.
Okay. This is from a section towards the end of the book called Last Song. The language about how we consider our landscape and our relationship to it is changing. Words like sustainable and renewable are being displaced by restoration and rewilding. I would like to add adaptation, compatibility, and emulation. Scientists realize that nature still does a better job of managing the earth than we do. All the processes and chemicals in China or the United States do not clean the water as well as a few plants in a bog. If anything, the chemicals make it worse. Scientists have made an honest effort to capture the value of nature in ways more specific than the gift metaphor I have used. Economists need this tool in order to convince developers and third world countries that the mangrove swamp is as valuable as the shrimp farm. The forest is necessary as the 37 houses, even though it does not generate revenue in the short term. The more I learned about this, the less I think that placing monetary value on undeveloped land and water will necessarily protect it. It might offer a way to plug certain transactions or descriptions into an Excel spreadsheet, but I think the gap offered by the gift notion is probably more accurate. The idea of the gap allows for the immeasurables of beauty, a relationship with the natural world, and all the things that we do not yet know, dark matter, dark energy, where the salmon go and what they do when they are not close to us, and so cannot measure. In the not so long term, if we manage to suffocate ourselves for lack of air and water, the monetary value of the land will not be of benefit to us. There is a call for a renewal of reverence for the natural world, from indigenous cultures to modern green religious practices, now that we have all but destroyed it and ourselves.
You are listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and that was Kathleen Akala reading from her latest book, and the book's called The Deepest Roots. The Deepest Roots, Kathleen, you are known as a writer of novels and creative nonfiction. You've explored your own family and the cultures of Mexico and the Southwest, and now here you are writing about the Northwest. What inspired you to begin this exploration into food security and sustainability here?
Well, what inspired me was my doctor calling me one morning at 8 a.m. and saying, "Your cholesterol is 300. You have to make an appointment and come in." And so it does feel as though it's a completely different subject in that I really had to pay attention in real time to my place in this environment and what I'm doing with it and what my relationship to it is. But it also allowed me to continue with this notion of what are our deepest roots. I think what I liked the most about it was that I finally found a way to synthesize this notion of culture and our physical existence, our DNA, I guess, our genetic makeup, in that I had to see how I needed to eat in order to honor my own background and so preserve my own health.
Well, it seems like the deepest roots on Bainbridge go all the way back to the indigenous people there, and you explored that in your book. It was fascinating.
Yes, the Suquamish have lived on and around Bainbridge Island for at least 10,000 years, and there's plenty of both archaeological and contemporary evidence for this. The reason that it was especially interesting to me was that I felt like a lot of the answers are already here. There's already a deep knowledge of the land and our relationship to it, and we see it lived out every day at Suquamish.
So what did they eat originally?
The Suquamish ate quite a lot. In fact, it turns out that our maritime climate offers more possibilities than almost any other part of the country in terms of readily available food. The landscape is edible. I also learned that a lot of what has commonly been thought to be more or less wild land was in fact deliberately cultivated and encouraged in certain directions. For example, the camas root grows in clearings, and so the Suquamish would regularly clear prairie-type areas so that the camas plant could grow. The root is either baked or dried and pounded and can be combined with dried salmon to make a portable food, make these little salmon cakes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sort of thing that comes directly from the land. I also learned that berries and all their many types and forms fill an important ecological niche that are filled by other fruits in other parts of the country. Part of my own heritage are from the Opata in the south of Arizona, northern Sonora, where squash and melons probably fill the same niche. So people eat a lot of berries here.
And now we look at Bainbridge today, and a lot of your book, you're starting to interview the people that are food providers and that have been for generations on Bainbridge. You had two kind of semi-apocalyptic questions that you went out and talked to people about. First of all, the first question, could this land support its own population?
Right.
And if there was a food shortage, is there some way I, as a storyteller, writer, could earn food from you? I think those are wonderful questions and certainly have been on the minds of people who are concerned about these issues. What happened? What did you find out?
Well, it was very interesting. It made people think about their relationship to the environment in a very different way than I think they were used to thinking about it. We were talking about berries, and before World War II, that was the biggest cash crop on the island, were strawberries. And the premier farmers were the Japanese Americans who grew the strawberries. So, of course, as we know, in World War II, all of that population was arrested and sent away to internment camps in communities that were away from the waterfront. So both the berry industry and the farming industry collapsed at that point and didn't recover until people came back to the island after World War II.
I found that to be a really interesting part of the book, where you follow some Bainbridge families and talk about what happened to them when they were sent away to the camps and how they were expected to grow their own food in such a different environment.
Yeah,
there's so many stories in this book that
there are so many stories.
That's right. Well, I want our audience to know that this is not the typical book about sustainability and farmers markets and growing your own food. It really looks into cultures and history. And I think one thing that came to mind was that our food, historically, we've been dependent upon the knowledge and labor of people of color. Do you feel that that's true still today?
Absolutely. And I think that Brendan McGill, who was one of the chefs I interviewed, was the most eloquent on that point when he talked about the fact that when you go to a regular grocery store and buy a tomato, you're not paying that much for it because they're growing them in mass quantity and not premier quality, whereas farmers on the island are hand-growing all of this food organically. And so Brendan McGill feels that when he buys food locally for his restaurant, he's getting the best quality. Also, he knows that the farmers are earning a living at it, and this is the thing about paying other people to grow our food? Do you want them to be able to have a living wage, or do you really want to use slave labor?
You know, here we are thinking about Bainbridge and, of course, our peninsula and the entire Puget Sound area. And we think of ourselves as being in kind of a climate oasis. Oh, we'll be okay. But one thing I found out reading your book is that there are real problems with what we need to grow enough to, you know, just supply our own population. Water is an issue, and you talk about that in the book as well.
Yes, water is an issue. There aren't any major rivers on Bainbridge Island or even that close to Port Townsend, mm-hmm. as I think about it.
Right.
So almost all of our water comes from the sky. It falls as rain on the land and is absorbed into the aquifers. So the more forests that we cut down and pave over or put houses on, the less water soaks into the ground and simply runs off the surface of the island. They're already having some difficulties with this in the San Juan Islands and even on Whidbey Island. So this is something that we have to pay attention to. As an island, we need to constantly monitor the balance between housing development, between forest and agricultural lands. And those three need to maintain a balance. We need to maintain a balance between the three in order for this to remain a living, thriving island community.
Part of your book discusses those kinds of issues and with the people that are actually providing food on Bainbridge. Let's talk about some of those folk. I believe you said that this book kind of emerged from a couple of interviews you've had with, for example, the Fortners. Tell us about the Fortners and how they went from used bookstore to Sweet Life Farm.
That was something that surprised me quite a bit because I knew them as the bookstore owners, the Fortner Books. At some point, they moved the bookstore from downtown to their garage where they sold used and rare books. And then they kind of switched over to a farm-based business called Sweet Life Farms. And they have a 10-acre land trust, of which they farm about an acre of it, and grow all of their own fruits and vegetables as well as chickens. And as part of that, the way that they get their cash now is by providing value-added products. And as part of this book, I got to learn all of these retail terms that I had never heard of before.
Mm-hmm. So if
so value-added product, when you're talking about food, is something that's been processed. That means canned vegetables, or it means an herbal tincture or cosmetic, or in this case, Dr. Bob's tonic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sort of thing that they've changed over to. But it turned out that this was part of a larger philosophy that they had been following all along. There was a couple named the Nearings who in the 1950s wrote a book about sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a resurgence again in the 70s of people sort of going back to the land and looking at what the Nearings had pioneered. The Fortners have been interested in this all along. Who knew?
I know. When I think about that book and think about Scott and Helen and their life, I believe it was in Vermont, or was it Maine? Okay.
It was Vermont.
And and what impact that book has had over the generations in the 70s when we were growing up and kind of going back to the land, and then again 30 years later, it's just amazing. So there were the Fortners, and then the incredible story of Paul Sportnick and a fisherman. And you'd think that in Bainbridge there would be the fishing going on there in the Puget Sound, but he took a completely different tact. So can you tell us about Paul and his fishing story?
Paul Sportnick is a third generation on the island Croatian fisher person. He and his wife, Lorraine, are both third-generation Croatian Americans. He did start out following what his father and grandfather had done, which was commercial fishing from fairly large boats that would go up the Inside Passage and fish near Alaska. But he really wanted to become a sustainable fisher person. So he experimented locally on what he could catch and what was feasible under local regulations, and finally ended up as a sustainable fisherman off of a sailboat off the coast of Oregon for tuna, for albacore tuna. And it's kind of mind-blowing. If you go online, I think you can find a photo of the book, which looks like something out of the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a wonderful boat. And he
it's
goes
called
out
the
by
ocean.
Himself.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
It's called Ocean, right? Does he still
yes,
have that?
Yes, it's called
boat?
Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Interviewing Paul, you could see his love of the ocean. He's really enthralled, and this is definitely his calling. This is his occupation. And he's able to catch enough fish to sell to the high-end sushi outfits and restaurants, and then they can the rest and sell
mm-hmm.
it locally.
Mm-hmm. Just independently make their living. And this is a sailboat.
This is a sailboat,
right.
Yes.
And I think
and line-caught tuna.
Yes, and line-caught. So really the opposite, very opposite from the way people think about tuna and tuna in their stores. So the,
right.
I love the story of Paul and his wife. And then you've talked also to younger people that are making their way, people like Betsy Wittick. Did I pronounce her name right?
Yes. Betsy is one of the farmers at the Day Road Farms, and she's also the manager of Bainbridge Island Wineries,
mm-hmm.
which have sort of combined forces as their founders have pretty much retired at this point. One of the really nice things I discovered in interviewing all of these people is that all the interns who work on the island are college graduates. And in fact, all the farmers who I interviewed before had college degrees. So this isn't something that people come to because there's nothing else that they could possibly do in the world. Nowadays, at least on Bainbridge, the people who are farmers are here because they want to be.
Is she successful, would you say, you know, making a living and supplying food from her farming, or is, you know, what she does is broader than that?
What she does is broader than that,
mm-hmm.
and that's fairly typical of the farmers here. She grows food. She sells it at the farmer's market. She's the manager of the winery, and as you know, wineries are getting to be a big deal in the Northwest. We have grapes that are adapted to the climate on Bainbridge Island, so that's the sort of thing that the winery retails
mm-hmm.
as wine. They
mm-hmm.
grow the grapes right there, and they turn it into wine, and you can come as a tourist and buy it. Brian McWhirter is another farmer who probably grows the most food on the island. And our grocery store, Town & Country, has contracted with Brian to grow organic vegetables just to be sold in their grocery stores. So if you go to one of the Town & Country markets, and there are five or six in the Puget Sound area,
mm-hmm.
if you see in the produce section vegetables that are called Middlefield Farms, those are grown on the island directly for the grocery store.
So the question, and that was another fascinating fact in your book, when you ask the local markets like Town & Country if they couldn't receive anything from the ferries or from the roads, how long would their food supply last?
Right. If we were cut off from the mainland on Bainbridge Island, which happens on a fairly regular basis, but
mm-hmm.
not for very long, we have a day's worth of food. And it's
one
not
day.
Just because the grocery store only has a day's worth. It's because most people don't keep any food in their house other than what they're going to eat for the next couple of meals,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which I found really surprising. We're just talking about preparedness on this island and the notion that if we are cut off during an emergency or an earthquake, we're pretty much on our own. In fact, I was in a neighborhood meeting not too long ago, and the fire chief came and he said, if somebody is seriously wounded in something like an earthquake, nobody's going to come from Seattle to rescue you. You're going
mm-hmm.
to have to make that person comfortable.
It's so not just 3 days for us, it's 7 days. It's more like 2 weeks of food.
Yes.
And then what happened when you talked to some of these people and said, well, you know, you're my neighbor and I know you and you're producing this kind of food. Can I expect to get some food from you? What was their reaction?
Well, that was sort of interesting, too, and I'm glad that you picked that up as you read the book. Some people said, oh, yes, I'll put you right to work. One woman, Marilyn Holt, said, well, I would expect you to be able to field dress an animal. And of course, that means to kill and clean and make into consumable parts an animal. And she raises cattle, so
I know, it's a little
if I
daunting.
Happen to go all the way over there, I guess I better take my own knife.
Faced with that, we'd eat just about anything, of course.
I think our expectations would rapidly evolve, let's put it that way.
They would. Part of this book is also a memoir. It's about your own interactions with food over the years, and especially in the last 6 years since you've been trying to change your diet and become more healthy. How does all of this connect with yourself as a cultural activist, as someone who is trying to find the right diet to eat in this time, in this place?
As I discovered that I had such high cholesterol, I realized that it was primarily genetic, especially since I didn't respond well to taking any sort of statins. So then I focused on diet and what I needed to eat to stay well.
Yeah. You've been called a cultural activist, and a lot of this book is written about your own search for the right kind of food and the right kind of diet. I remember one part where you're talking about eating a carrot in Mexico and how different it tasted from the carrots that you were eating up north. Tell us a little bit about how you found your way with your own diet.
Right. It's been a matter of trial and error. But one of the things I started to do was grow my own food and have my own plot. One of the things I learned after eating that delicious carrot in Guanajuato was that it was probably grown for local consumption. And most of the carrots we eat are, as well as tomatoes and other vegetables, are of a type that can be harvested way before they're expected to be eaten and then shipped. So the carrots that we get in the grocery store are typically harder and not as sweet as what I was eating in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And that goes for things like tomatoes as well. So I gradually worked my way into keeping a small plot, 10 by 10, and growing vegetables. And although I had done it before, I hadn't done it consistently year after year and get into that whole cycle with the seasons of what's available and what's not available. And by doing that, of course, I also got in touch with all of the other people on the island who do grow their own vegetables. Of course, everybody's great quest here is, of course, the perfect tomato, right?
Mm-hmm.
The perfect tomato in a climate that doesn't grow perfect tomatoes. But it's certainly a good hobby to go after this sort of thing. I also met a beekeeper and learn firsthand how important bees are to our environment and to most of the fruits and vegetables that we eat. We went through this business with the bees crashing. I'm not sure if that's still going on or not. I think that we're figuring out that some of the herbicides we use are in fact harmful to the bees, even though we had thought before that they were not.
Yeah,
so we get into this thing where everything is really interconnected. The food that we eat is connected to the bees, is connected to our own health, and is connected to the history of the land and how we've treated it, right? And how we've treated the people who grew our food.
I was wondering if you could turn to near the end of the book, page 323, and that's the postscript, Last Song. And if you could just read a couple of paragraphs of imagining a time when there is a food crisis and what would happen. Because I think you do a great job of making that really come to life.
I wanted to add right here mm-hmm. that one of the touchstones that I used as I kept reminding the reader about the deep knowledge that's at our disposal is the petroglyph at the north end of the island. I'm looking at the mm-hmm. rubbing here that's facing this page. And it's called Chalitz and is part of the Suquamish inheritance and has been much discussed and much interpreted, but I think is tied into this. Last song. Say you live on an island in a temperate maritime climate. One day, out of the blue, the ferry sinks to the bottom of Puget Sound, and the bridge across Agate Passage falls down. You are now on an island with 23,000 other people, assuming they all made it back from their jobs in Seattle. If it was during the day, they did not. Power is down, of course. Eventually, the cars will run out of fuel, the generators at TNC will give up, and you will need to affirm yourself as a member of the community worthy of having something to eat. Say that a few months earlier, several hundred people joined you from another country, refugees from their own disaster, and were settled at Battle Point Park, where tents and portable toilets were set up. When it became clear that we would need to share our limited resources with them for the long term, there was some resentment on the parts of the residents. But the new people, or the old people, I forget which, divided the park into rice paddies, restored the nearby creek so the salmon would run again, and planted mulberry trees from tiny starts, the only food for silkworms, which they brought over as cocoons in padded boxes. Eventually, we will tear up and plant the two golf courses with crops. You will dig up the lawn. You will plant pieces of a potato you found at the bottom of the refrigerator when you cleaned it out, looking for anything at all to eat. You will try to figure out what part of the salal plant is edible and how to fix it. One day, you will follow a deer for hours through the ravine, taking note of what plants it pauses to eat and which ones it passes by. You will scour the beaches for clams and start eyeing that squirrel in the yard in a new light. The neighbor's dog will cease to be a problem because the neighbors will have eaten him.
Thank you, Kathleen. We can go on from there, but today we've been talking to Kathleen Alcala. She's the author of The Deepest Roots, Finding Food and Community on a Pacific Northwest Island. Please join me next time for more talk about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page on the website, kpdz.org. And today I'd like to thank Mike Schlexer, who's in the booth with me, and all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible. Please stay tuned to hear someone wonderful, someone like Delana, music to my ears, or someone like Taylor, who's going to be playing the blues later on. And we'll see you next time.